KALW.
The first event that I threw here, I was just like, oh, if you build it, they will come and it will be your people.
There's a new community event venue near Oakland's Jack London Square, but it's hidden.
It's pretty cool, too, because I feel like people reach out and I get to be like, do I want a concert of this, like, in my downstairs? Like, yeah, I do. Yeah, I think I do.
A visit to Oakland's secret. Then, why are firefighters burning out? We hear about the mental health crisis plaguing firefighter communities.
I talked to a CAL FIRE captain, and he said he had heard in California that week 10 suicides.
And we'll hear from mayoral hopeful Daniel Lurie.
It took on average 1,100 days to get through the permitting process here in San Francisco. That's where the breakdown is.
The race to City Hall. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Today, we start with a new story from our series, Culture Keepers, celebrating the Bay Area's unique spaces and communities.
People just look at it like you're just driving a piece of junk on the streets. But to us, it's like a canvas on wheels.
There's a lot of dirt, rocks, love, and sweat. Maybe a couple of cigarettes.
Do coffee. Do something. No rights reserved, no wrongs preserved.
I felt like I was with my people.
Just a short walk from Jack London Square in Oakland, there's an old Victorian home that stands out from its neighbors. From the outside, it seems quiet and unassuming, but on the inside, it holds a secret, Oakland's secret. It's a DIY event venue and housing cooperative that's creating community for queer people and artists. KLW's Cherie Bishop uncovers the secret to hosting events for the public from your own home.
Kat Frazier is giving me a tour of her home that she shares with other members of Oakland Secret's housing cooperative. The living room and kitchen look like a lot of the shared housing that I've seen before. It's filled with mismatched and well-loved furniture, a brown couch, a yellow armchair, a wooden dining table. You can tell that a lot of people have passed through here.
And this is where we have like meetings and hang out. It just depends.
Above the sink, there's a huge window.
You're overlooking like sort of the industrial area right before you get to Jack London Square. And then you also before that see the train tracks, but we're really high up.
The folks who live here don't mind the noise from the city. It kind of comes with the territory. It's not just a home. It's also an event space that hosts all kinds of stuff, from punk shows to figure drawing nights. Kat takes me downstairs to show me where the community events happen.
So this is the art gallery side. The art gallery side. We do things like host arts markets, dance parties, music showcases.
Next to the art gallery, there's a bike shop.
So we do free or low-cost bike repairs. And so this space is really where people can come in, bring their bikes, get them fixed, learn how to build a bike.
And there's a backyard with a stage, some seating, and a bar that's covered with this glittery purple tablecloth.
I love this bar, and then I also love all the plants. And one of the neat things about having a music space, or even just a space to collect in between the BART and the highway, is that you always have this kind of like background sound, but you don't really have to worry about like making too much noise. It's just kind of like all part of the space.
Usually event venues need to consider neighbors and noise, but they don't have to do that here. It means they can put on all kinds of events.
It's really a versatile space, and it's until like I basically started working at Oakland Secret, I didn't realize how much you can do with a space like this.
On top of living here, Kat is the unofficial manager of Oakland Secret, though the house members don't like to use labels. All of them spend their time helping this space run smoothly. That means knowing their way around all of the equipment they have for different events.
So we have the piano, we have the stage, and then we also have the projector, so bands play here. And then we also have like film screenings, and you can see the huge Oakland Secret key, which is kind of new.
On the back wall, there's a painting of a key. Next to it, Oakland Secret is spelled out in large white letters. And it isn't as if one person decided to decorate the place a certain way. Both the residential area and the event space are run cooperatively.
If there's something huge, like we want to repaint this bathroom, that's going to be a vote, right?
It's not just decorations. The collective also deals with financial decisions.
it's completely different than just kind of living with roommates because, you know, we have a house fund that the event space goes towards. So even financially, we're all supporting each other financially, emotionally. And, you know, sometimes contributions are bigger from other people, between people or whatever. But the whole idea of the cooperative is that we're all collectively making a decision and benefiting from that decision.
There are some challenges, though, that come with putting on these DIY events.
That first show for me was, like, kind of difficult.
There was feedback from the mics and the stage wasn't set up correctly, but in the end, it worked out fine.
The first event that I threw here, I was just like, oh, if you build it, they will come and it will be your people. One thing I love about the space is, like, there's always something new to learn. You'll find that out when we do the setup.
Lilith Spills, another member of Oakland Secret, is hosting tonight's show.
1, 2, 3, testing. Mic check. 1, 1, 1, 1, testing.
So tonight's event is going to be a touring band. They're from New Orleans.
While the band gets set up, Lilith writes out tonight's show on a sandwich board for the sidewalk.
And then we have drugstore lipstick. What you can't see is that I don't actually have great handwriting.
A little while later, a handful of people come in to watch. On a small stage, Slade from Drugstore Lipstick performs a few songs with her mixer. Lilith, tonight's host, dances while the bands play. The music is loud, which, at times, can be the hard part of living here.
I think the noise can be a hard part if I don't like the music, to be honest, because I'm going to hear it no matter what.
But the biggest downside and the biggest perk of living at Oakland Secret are one and the same.
It's pretty cool, too, because I feel like people reach out and I get to be like, do I want a concert of this, like, in my downstairs? Like, yeah, I do. Yeah, I think I do.
After the show, Slade from Drugstore Lipstick told me what makes this venue unique from the other ones she's performed at.
I mean, you're in this venue, it's like you're in someone's home. It's not a house show because it's a stage, but it's different from a venue because people are here to listen and they're here to engage in whatever beautiful thing the house is planned.
That's the secret. You can go to a show, you can go over to your friend's house, you can be in community, but here at Oakland Secret, it's all of those things at once. In Oakland, I'm Cherie Bishop for Cross Currents.
Cherie reported that story as part of our summer journalism program. Find more of her work at klw.org/crosscurrents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Henat Baba. Next, we'll turn to mental health, the mental health of firefighters. As fires in California grow bigger and last longer, the people on the front lines facing them are burning out. Firefighters in the state are increasingly struggling with PTSD, depression, and suicide. Reporter Julie Cart from Cal Matters has been reporting on this and wrote a 6-part series investigating what's causing this mental health crisis and what's being done about it. How did you first hear about this problem?
When there are big fire seasons, the U.S. Forest Service and CAL FIRE have kind of regular briefings for the media to talk about what it's looking like, what the outlook is, and what fires are burning. And a couple of years ago, for the first time, I heard fire service officials who are tough guys. You know, this is a quasi-military, paramilitary operation, which they call it that. They're fairly stoic folks. For the first time, I heard them talking about fatigue, stress, the difficulties that crews were facing, both with the actual environment in which they're working, the ferocity of the fires, the size of the fires, the never-ending seasons, but also these guys work 21-day shifts. So you're away from home. That's a very long time to be on a 24-hour basis, you know, ready for work, because in California, we burn so many homes. They're not wildfires in a distant forest that we're talking about. They're in homes, in backyards and subdivisions, and it's very difficult for them because sometimes they're neighbors. There are many firefighters who fight fires in their own homes or against their own homes. So it was just more and more stressful, and they were voicing that, and that's not very common. So it was kind of the first time that I heard these sorts of confessions in a way.
And so when you started looking into these mental health issues, what was coming up?
Mental health issues present differently with different people and different populations, but there was stress doing the job, fear and anxiety regarding fire, your colleagues and their health and that kind of thing. PTSD sometimes comes on in a cumulative fashion, years and years and years of something, and then it breaks one day. Someday it's been described to me many times by different firefighters. It's a drip, 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 and then one day the bucket overflows.
And if we kind of zoom in to PTSD in particular, it's been described as an epidemic among firefighters. I want to talk about that in connection to what you said earlier about there's a culture of bravery among firefighters and stoicism. How do those two connect?
Well, they connect poorly for bad outcomes. You are in a service where, again, if you have a kind of a military model in your mind, it helps you understand how these folks work. You're in a unit, and you're trained that each person is critical. You're only as strong as your weakest link, the cliche. But it's quite true in the mindset. I cannot let my team down. I could harm my inability to do my job, could hurt other people, it could hurt the public, resources are at risk, that kind of thing. So there's a lot of pressure to hold up your end of the work. And what happens is, even if something traumatic happens, if there's what's called in fire service a burnover, so people are trapped, firefighters are trapped, and a fire's coming toward them and they have to deploy these shelters and things like that, that always triggers an automatic review. And in those reviews, you would expect to hear people say, it was frightening. We felt like we were roasting alive. The sounds that are associated with fires as they move, it's like a roaring train. They don't. They say, we made a mistake, or we got trapped here, the wind changed, and they're very perfunctory. So you don't want to appear to be weak. And unfortunately, as we all know in this country, mental health issues, when you talk about them, it sometimes people perceive that as a weakness. So the connection between this stress and their inability or unwillingness or maybe discouraged from talking about these problems, it just makes things worse and worse. You feel like you're the only person who feels that way. You suppress, you don't talk about that, you don't process it, and everyone thinks you're fine.
Can you talk about Captain Noel Bonmiller, who developed PTSD after witnessing a big fire in 2014?
She is kind of an amazing firefighter who's done lots of different things in her career. She takes her job quite seriously. And frankly, women of upper positions in CAL FIRE are not common. And there's extra pressure on them, as we can imagine, to do their job well, to do it better, to be brave. And, you know, all those things we're talking about in this context. So she was on a ridge and her team was trapped. And she was concerned about her team members who were trapped and pinned down. And it kind of fed into a general fear she had or a concern. And she was hearing radio traffic of a fire that turned. And so she was imagining, by listening to the people's talk on the radio, all these horrible things, and expected to find her crew members dead. And she said that that really changed things for her. She became hypervigilant. She started, her behavior changed quite a lot. She didn't sleep at all. She said that after that, she would drive along a road and she'd see a tree, and she saw it catch on fire and flames coming out the top, which I thought was an unusual thing, of course, until I heard somebody else say the exact same thing. They look like torches to them. So they look at a landscape that we think is lovely and benign, and they see it as this menacing thing.
Right. And then there was a day that she was about to take her life, and instead she called a helpline number. She attended group therapy and trauma therapy. Which makes me think about this other question. What kind of support is available to people in that field?
So what's available? CAL FIRE is not a mental health care operation. That's not what they offer. The insurance you get from as a state employee does have mental health care stuff. So they kind of do a triage. I think there's about 24 or so folks who work in, you know, in this area with a staff that in the summer can get up to 8,000. So you're not going to get to everybody. But people can go to them as a safe space and say, I'm having this problem, or I keep thinking about X. And then the job of that person in the mental health field is to find other folks to talk to. They're moving them. So it's triage. And then from there, you're in the insurance system, which is itself not very easy to navigate.
Is there any acknowledgement that this is an epidemic and that this is a big problem that needs to be dealt with in terms of CAL FIRE doing more?
Well, yes and no. One of the things I tried to do, and now this has been 2 years of writing these things, is to get data. There is no data, and that's because CAL FIRE doesn't ask anyone. They do not track. I talked to a CAL FIRE captain 2 years ago when I was writing the first series, first parts, and he said he had heard in California that week 10 suicides. And I said, you're kidding me. It's not reflected anywhere. CAL FIRE doesn't track it. They don't follow who, if someone dies in the line of duty or someone is retired or someone off duty dies, there's not a notation that says drove his car off a cliff or whatever it might be. There are people who are willing to call it a crisis, just as there's a, you might argue there's a mental health crisis in this, the country today, certainly of reporting and understanding and responding to it. But they can kind of hide behind the fact or diminish it by saying, we don't, you know, where's your data? You're just being alarmist. But I'm quite convinced that there's a serious, serious problem.
So where do you see hope and where are you optimistic that change can happen?
So we need to sort of destigmatize this and find a way to make it okay to talk about it. And because that is a lot of help for people to be in a place where it's true for all of us. Someone looks like us who understands what I'm going through. And wow, I didn't know anybody else felt the same way. It's a big deal. And I think that's very helpful. And that would be the glimmer that there are these folks who are brave enough. I'm sorry it takes bravery, but it does. To say, I'm having this, you know, I want to kill myself. I'm afraid, on and on. And I think that's a big start.
That's reporter Julie Cart from CAL Matters. Her 6-part series on firefighter mental health is called Trial by Fire, The Trauma of Fighting California's Wildfires. We'll have a link to the series at klw.org. That interview was produced by Hussein Khan. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Next, we'll hear a conversation our friends from KLW's State of the Bay had with mayoral hopeful Daniel Lurie. He is the heir to the Levi Strauss clothing company and founder of Tipping Point Community, an anti-poverty organization that focuses on fighting homelessness, an issue the Supreme Court weighed in on recently with their Grants Pass decision that allows cities to sweep encampments even when there are no available shelter beds. In this conversation with State of the Bay, Lurie connects solutions to homelessness with building affordable housing. Here's the host, Grace Wan.
You hear a lot from homeless advocates saying that, you know, shelter beds are good, but a lot of people don't want to be in shelters because they can't bring their things, they can't bring their pets, there are too many rules. So right. when you talk about building shelter beds, do you also want to try to build affordable housing as well?
So I've also built affordable housing, but just to be clear about Tipping Point's mission, an organization I started in 2005 and has raised over $500 million to tackle issues of poverty ranging from education, which is actually what we funded the most, early childhood education, also housing and employment. So we funded four issue areas. One of those was housing and homelessness. And I told you that we built shelter, but we also did build affordable housing. We got a project done at 833 Bryant. We got it done on time, under budget, with good paying union labor. It took us from the time we bought the parking lot to the time somebody opened the door, it was 3 years and $377,000 a unit. And this administration has failed to take our model and really double down on it. We should be building more affordable housing for our teachers, for our nurses, for our firefighters, for our first responders, and for the people that make this city go. We need to build more affordable housing. I'm confident that we can do it because I've done it.
Well, you know, from that experience of building those units in 3 years, which probably in other places of the country, that feels like a really long time. But in San Francisco, that feels like a little bit of a miracle. Yeah. What is replicable about that model on a citywide level?
Well, we finally saw a second version of it just last week announced. Apple and John Sobrato, along with the Housing Accelerator Fund, we're going to use the money actually from 833 Bryant and a few other sources to build 135 units of senior housing. What's replicable is making sure that we bring people together to cut down on the time and the cost it takes. So that project at Valencia Street and Mission should take, still should just take 3 years. It'll be $577,000 a unit. But partnering with people like Rebecca Foster and the Housing Accelerator Fund, getting creative on our financing, unlocking. We do have 70,000 units that have been approved. Yes, the high interest rates are causing problems. Mm-hmm. Hopefully those start coming down and we can start building more housing. But we need to get the unions on board. We need to get them to the table. It's what we did at Tipping Point, and I'll do that as mayor.
What makes building a unit of housing like that so expensive? Again, these are numbers in San Francisco that we all sort of say, oh, $577,000, okay. But in other parts of the country, they're just kind of scratching their heads wondering, my gosh, why does it cost so much to build a single unit of housing in San Francisco? Is there any way to bring those costs down?
Yeah, Grace, the City Hall insiders I'm running against, you've interviewed the other four.
Mm-hmm.
They've built up this broken, ineffective, and frankly, corrupt City Hall bureaucracy. It took on average 1,100 days to get through the permitting process here in San Francisco. That's where the breakdown is. They've created so much bureaucracy, so much red tape that it has caused the state to come in and take over our planning commission in the sense that SB 423 has now come in. And, you know, you had the mayor and Senator Weir kind of celebrating the state coming in. But it's years of failure in the making. Now, I think it will help us get housing built more quickly, which I am for. But we still have to then, once you get through planning, you still have to go through the Department of Building and Inspections. And on average, Grace, it takes 600 days to get through that. This is why John Ram, the former planning commissioner, has endorsed me, because he knows that my plan will get and expedite housing, and that what has been built up over the last 15 years in this city is broken, dysfunctional, and corrupt.
Well, I think anybody who's ever tried to do a renovation in San Francisco just kind of winced at that number with familiarity. I wanted to move on to public safety, which is another cornerstone of your campaign. Recently, the police announced a new policy to restrict pretextual stops, and that would be traffic stops for low-level violations. The new rules just specifically prohibits officers from pulling over drivers for having, like, one non-working taillight or an item hanging from a rearview mirror or a missing license plate, among other violations. Do you support that?
Well, you said the police came out with that or the police commission?
The police commission, yes. But do you support that?
Here's how I would approach this. We need a fully staffed police department. We need our officers walking the beat, out on patrol, deterring and preventing crime. Some of those low-level things, I think DPT, Department of Parking and Traffic, could be doing. I think we need more red light cameras, more speed cameras, catching offenders, and making sure that our police are able to do the work of policing.
That was mayoral candidate Daniel Lurie talking with State of the Bay host Gray Swan in April. You can hear a longer version of that conversation and all our election coverage at klw.org/elections. And while you're there, tell us what local issues are on your mind for the upcoming election. Today's Cross Currents team includes Arun Nair, Zen Iqbal, James Rowlands, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tense, Shirin Adil, Marissa Ortega Welch, Angela Johnston, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.